BBC World Service. In the first part of 2013, the Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield spent 5 months in command of the International Space Station. His new book offers an insight into his career and some of his more dramatic experiences. Gary Kagan reads extracts from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
One morning, a strange thought occurs to me shortly after waking. The socks I am about to put on are the ones I'll wear to leave Earth. That prospect feels real yet surreal, the way a particularly vivid dream does. The feeling intensifies at breakfast, when reporters jostle each other to get a good photo, as though I'm a condemned man and this is my last meal. Similarly, a little later on, when the technicians help me into my custom-made spacesuit for pressure checks, the joviality feels forced. It's the moment of truth. The suit needs to function perfectly. It's what will keep me alive and able to breathe if the spacecraft depressurizes in the vacuum of space. Because this isn't a run-through. I am actually leaving the planet today. Once everyone in the crew is suited up, we all get into the elevator in crew quarters to ride down to the ground and out to our rocket ship. When we finally head outside to walk toward the big silver astro van that will take us to the launch pad, it's that moment that everyone knows. Flash bulbs pop in the pre-dawn darkness. The crowd cheers. We wave and smile. In the van, we can see the rocket in the distance, lit up and shining. An obelisk. In reality, of course, it's a 4.5-megaton bomb loaded with explosive fuel, which is why everyone else is driving away from it. At the launch pad, we ride the elevator up, and one by one we crawl into the vehicle on our hands and knees. Then the closeout crew helps strap me tightly into my tiny seat, and one of them hands me a note from Helena, telling me she loves me. As every second passes, the odds improve that we're going to space today. 6 seconds to go. The engines start to light, and we sway forward as this huge new force bends the vehicle, which lurches sideways, then twangs back to vertical. And at that moment, there's an enormous, violent vibration and rattle. It feels as though we're being shaken in a huge dog's jaws, then seized by its giant unseen master and hurled straight up into the sky, away from Earth. It feels like magic, like winning, like a dream. It also feels as though a huge truck going at top speed just smashed into the side of us. Perfectly normal, apparently, and we'd been warned to expect it. So I just keep staring at the buttons and lights over my head, scanning the computers for signs of trouble, trying not to blink. The launch tower is long gone, and we're roaring upward, pinned down increasingly emphatically in our seats as the vehicle burns fuel, gets lighter, and 45 seconds later, pushes past the speed of sound. 30 seconds after that, we're flying higher and faster than Concorde ever did, Mach 2 and still revving up. It's like being in a dragster, just flooring it. 2 minutes after liftoff, we're hurtling along at 6 times the speed of sound when the solid rocket boosters explode off the vehicle and we surge forward again. I'm still completely focused on my checklist, but out of the corner of my eye, I register that the color of the sky has gone from light blue to dark blue to black. And then suddenly, calm. We reach Mach 25. Orbital speed. The engines wind down, and I notice little motes of dust floating lazily upward. Upward. Experimentally, I let go of my checklist for a few seconds and watch it hover then drift off serenely instead of thumping to the ground. I feel like a little kid, like a sorcerer, like the luckiest person alive. I am in space, weightless, and getting here took only 8 minutes and 42 seconds. Give or take a few thousand days of training. That was my first launch on Space Shuttle Atlantis, years ago now, November 12, 1995. But the experience still feels so vivid and immediate that it seems inaccurate somehow to describe it in the past tense. Despite having traveled 3.4 million miles, I didn't feel I'd arrived at my destination. An astronaut was something I was still in the process of becoming. Scott and I were floating head to toe in our spacesuits, carefully and slowly depressurizing the airlock and checking and rechecking the LED displays on our suits to make sure they were functioning properly and could keep us alive in the vacuum of space. If we got out there and somehow there was a leak in the suit, our lungs would rupture, our eardrums would burst, our saliva, sweat, and tears would boil, and we'd get the bends. The only good news is that within 10 to 15 seconds, we'd lose consciousness. Lack of oxygen to the brain is what would finish us off. When the airlock has finally depressurized, I grab the handle on the hatch and turn it. Time to go out. My exit will not be graceful, but my number one concern at this point is to avoid floating off into space. So, just as we've been taught, I'm tethered to Scott, who is attached to the structure, and I'm holding another tether to attach to the rail mounted on the side of the shuttle. I lower the gold shield on my visor to protect my eyes from the sun, and carefully, gingerly, wriggle my bulky, square, suited self out of the airlock. I'm still inside the belly of the beast in the payload bay, but my suit has become my own personal spaceship, responsible for keeping me alive. Emerging from the bay, my existence narrows to a single point of focus, attaching my tether to the braided wire strung from one end of the vehicle to another. I lock onto that and tell everyone I'm securely tethered. Now Scott can detach inside and come join me. Waiting for him, I check behind me to make sure I haven't accidentally activated my backup tank of oxygen. And that's when I notice the universe. The scale is graphically shocking. The colors, too. The incongruity is stupefying. There I was, inside a small box, but now, how is this possible? Holding onto the side of a spaceship that's moving around the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour, I could truly see the astonishing beauty of our planet, the infinite textures and colors. On the other side of me, the black velvet bucket of space, brimming with stars. I could drink it in forever. Only here's Scott, out of the airlock, floating over toward me. We get to work. After about 5 hours, the installation is going well, when I suddenly become aware that droplets of water are floating around inside my helmet. We've never figured out how to make food work inside the suit. It's been messy and more of a hindrance than a help. So typically, we just have a water bag. You bite on the straw to open a little valve at one end, then suck out water. Hypothetically, anyway. My water bag hadn't worked right since we started the EVA, and now it was apparently leaking. Great! I'm trying to ignore these little globs of water floating around in front of my face when suddenly my left eye starts stinging. Wickedly. It feels like a large piece of grit has been smashed into my eye, and instinctively I reach up to rub it, and my hand smacks into the visor of my helmet. You're in a spacesuit, moron, I remind myself under my breath. I try blinking repeatedly and whipping my head hard from side to side to try to dislodge whatever it is, but my eye keeps stinging and won't stay open for more than a blurry second before snapping shut again. We've trained for many eventualities, but partial blindness was not one of them. So, what to do? Well, take stock. I'm tightening the bolts on Canadarm 2 using a big handheld drill. My feet are clicked into place in the foot restraints, and my tether is firmly attached to the station. I'm at no imminent risk. The rest of my senses are fine, and I've still got one good eye. I decide to keep working and tell no one. So I move on to the next bolt and start torquing it into place. My left eye, however, is now not only smarting, but actually filling with tears. In weightlessness, tears don't flow downward. They just sit there, and as you keep on crying, a bigger and bigger ball of salty liquid accumulates to form a wobbly bubble on your eyeball. The growing ball of tears in my left eye easily oozes over the bridge of my nose, promptly invading my right, which also snaps shut, because whatever's contaminating the left eye hasn't been diluted by my tears, so now my right eye is tearing heavily too. I try to force my eyes open, but there's not much point. All I can see is a watery blur before my reflexes kick in and my eyelids close. In the space of just a few minutes, I've gone from 20/20 vision to blind, in space, holding a drill. Houston, EV1, I have a problem. As the words come out of my mouth, I can picture the reaction on the ground. Everyone at Mission Control will be galvanized. People will start tossing out theories about causes, wondering aloud what this means operationally, and trying to figure out solutions. Scott is still working away on the wiring on another part of the station. Pointless for him to stop and make his way over, as there's absolutely nothing he can do for me. Of course, if it turns out there's no way to solve my problem, he'll have to lead me back to the airlock and get me safely inside. But we both agree we're not at that point yet. Fortunately, the flight director knows me well, and he's willing to cut me a lot of slack instead of ordering me back inside, pronto. He lets me sit tight for a bit, while people scramble to figure out just how much danger I'm in. This being the space business, they go straight to the worst-case scenario. Maybe the problem is related to the air purification system in the spacewalking suit, which relies on lithium hydroxide to remove carbon dioxide. Lithium hydroxide is really caustic and can severely damage your lungs. Eye irritation is one of the first signs that there's been a leak, so maybe I'm experiencing early symptoms of lithium hydroxide exposure and I've only got a couple more minutes to live. Control calmly tells me to open my purge valve, essentially to open a hole in my suit and start flushing out the potentially contaminated air I've been breathing until it's all gone, or at least highly diluted by the fresh oxygen being pumped into my suit. Luckily, I've practiced so many times that I can reach up beside my left ear and open it with no problem and no eyesight and start dumping my air into space. So now I'm blind, listening to a hissing noise as my oxygen merrily burbles out into the universe. It's a curiously peaceful moment. Spacewalking is largely a visual experience. Your other senses are barely stimulated. The brilliant colors of the Earth, the shining reflections off the spaceship, and the profound blackness of space are what confirm to you where you are. Without sight, my body is telling me that nothing at all out of the ordinary is going on. I feel more like I'm under the covers at home in bed, dreaming about the space station, than hanging onto the side of it, in mortal danger. The fact that I'm not coughing makes me reasonably confident there hasn't been a lithium hydroxide leak. I have to let the people on the ground do their job and purge my oxygen as a precaution. But I need to get back to work. So I start trying everything I can think of to unblind myself, shaking my head around to try to brush my eyes against something in the helmet, blinking for all I'm worth. I know the doctors are undoubtedly saying, "We've got to bring him inside right this minute and figure out what's going on." So I say, "Know what? I feel no lung irritation at all, and I think my eyes are starting to clear a little bit." It's even sort of true. My eyes are still killing, but I feel marginally less sightless. I ask if I can stop purging oxygen, and Mission Control agrees. Meanwhile, I keep blinking and blinking and blinking, and thankfully, 20 minutes on, I can now see a little bit. Sure, my eyes still sting and everything looks a bit cloudy, but a couple more minutes pass, and I think I can see well enough to continue installing the arm. I tell the ground I'm ready to get back to work. Happily, the response is, "All right, you're the one there, and you know best what the situation is." In the meantime, Mission Control instructs the crew inside the shuttle to get the medical gear ready so that when I come back in, they can sample my tears to try to figure out what the problem is. Not until we've repressurized the airlock and are actually back inside our spaceship do I let myself relax. As soon as I do, I feel completely drained and just float limply, shivering with cold. My body is out of fuel. Later, discussing what went wrong, the capsule communicator asked, "Chris, did you remember to use your anti-fog stuff?" Of course I had. The night before, I'd polished the visor of the suit so it wouldn't fog up like a ski mask. "Well, we think you didn't do it perfectly. Probably you didn't get it all off." Apparently the solution is basically dishwashing detergent. Mix it with a few droplets of loose water, and it's as though you've squirted soap directly into your eye. My first response to this news was, "Really? We're using detergent? No Tears baby shampoo wasn't an option?" When I went out for my next EVA 2 days later, I wiped off my visor so vigorously that I'm surprised I didn't rub right through the thing. Shortly after we got to the ISS, I started making brief videos about these only-in-space aspects of everyday life, which the Canadian Space Agency posted on its website, as well as on YouTube. Making the videos was easy for me. I just press record on an HD video camera and demonstrate something, such as how to use the treadmill or wash your hands. The most popular videos we made were the ones about everyday space oddities. Luckily, there was no shortage of them. For instance, after a few months, the soles of my feet were nearly as smooth as a baby's and free of calluses. They only bore weight when I ran. Meanwhile, the tops of my feet had become calloused from rubbing against the footholds that prevented me from floating off while conducting an experiment, say, or taking a photograph. I think one reason people like hearing about these sorts of things is that it helps them see the world slightly differently, perhaps even with a sense of wonder. I'd been posting pictures on Twitter, mostly related to my pre-flight training, for 2 years, primarily because my son Evan had told me to. He thought that when I got to the ISS, I should be marketing the beauty and wonder of space. I tweeted my first photos on December 22nd, when I had about 20,000 Twitter followers. 2 days later, I tweeted a link to a recording I'd just made of "Jewel in the Night," a song my brother Dave wrote. It was a first take. I'd literally pressed record on my iPad and started strumming, so you could hear typical station noises in the background. Evan decided to post the link on a number of different sites to see whether it gained traction anywhere. The only way for me to explain what happened next is that my son had some time on his hands over the holidays. On January 2nd, I had 42,700 Twitter followers. By January 7th, there were almost 115,000. Suddenly, there were articles in newspapers and magazines, as well as online, about the photos I'd been posting. Evan wanted me to do one more thing. Make the first music video in space. He wanted me to sing David Bowie's Space Oddity. First, he rewrote some of the words of the song. In his version, the astronaut lives and the Soyuz and station are both mentioned. Next, I recorded the audio track using a mic and my iPad. Only after we got David Bowie's permission did I shoot the video. Using a camera mounted on a flexible arm, I filmed myself floating through different parts of the station. I was pleased with the video, and Evan had worked out a master plan for its release during my final days on the ISS. But once I'd finished my part, I hardly thought about it. As our time on station drew to a close, I felt a sense of real anticipation about my first Soyuz landing. Returning to Earth in the shuttle was a fairly gentle experience, but Soyuz landings are famously rough. High G-forces, heavy vibration, rapid spinning and tumbling, all funneling down to a brutally jarring thud on the unforgiving Kazakh plains. On the very last day, despite the flurry of activity, I felt a need to be alone in this incredible place, physically and mentally. I deliberately went to the cupola and spent some time trying to soak up the feeling of being there, to internalize what it felt like and what the world looked like from that vantage point. I wanted to acknowledge the significance of the time I'd spent on the ISS and everything it had meant to me. Then the clock struck 3:30, and we said hurried goodbyes to the other crew, hustled into the Soyuz, and closed the hatches. Undocking is a peaceful contrast to the fiery pageantry of launch. It takes about 3 minutes for the giant hooks and catches to release. Our Soyuz is a small barnacle clinging to a massive ship, but gradually, little springs push us away, and we drift off as our friends watch from the windows of the ISS, waving farewell. It's calm now, but I take anti-nausea meds. I know tranquility is only temporary. After about 2.5 hours, it's time. We turn the ship tail first and set up for deorbit burn, firing the engines for 4 minutes and 20 seconds. There's a critical moment during the burn when there's no turning back. You've decelerated so much that you're committed to falling into the atmosphere. We passed this point and felt the vehicle pushing on our backs like a solid hand. The sensation is that you're accelerating in the other direction, but actually you're slowing down. What follows is a wild 54-minute tumble to Earth that feels more or less like 15 explosions followed by a car crash. It's getting hotter and more humid. Looking out, I see orange-yellow flames and a stream of high-speed sparks pouring off the vehicle, and hear a series of bangs. Either there's a flaw in the protective shield, or some trapped moisture, or we've got a real problem. I don't say anything, because what is there to say? If the shield fails, we're dead. We are a fiery bullet slicing through space, coming into sunrise. The G-force builds rapidly to 3.8 times Earth weight. I can feel the heaviness of the skin on my face as it's mashed back toward my ears. My arms seem to weigh a ton, and suddenly it's a strain to lift one, even a few inches, to flick a switch on the control panel. Going from weightlessness to max G and then back to the 1G experienced on Earth only takes 10 minutes, but it's a long 10 minutes. Once we've slowed significantly, our drogue chute opens to cut our rate of descent. At 17,000 feet, the main chute opens, and we're laughing, yelling, "Yee-haw!" 2 seconds before impact, Our optimistically named soft landing rockets fire gunpowder charges that cut our descent rate to 5 feet per second. They turn a horrific car crash into a survivable one. We hit the hard ground of Kazakhstan, a ton of steel, titanium, and human flesh. It's windy on the steppe, so our chute drags us over onto our side, and we roll end over end a few times until Roman flicks a switch to cut the parachute lines, and we stop. Next thing you know, the hatch is being pried open, and there's blue sky, bright sunshine, the smell of fresh air and living things, a commotion of voices. Arms reach in to lift Roman out of the capsule. Someone else digs out the samples and science, the things that need to be put in a freezer or on a plane right away. Tom is carried out next. Then it's my turn. I was NASA's rep at several landings, so the ground crew knows me. And the guy who lifts me out says in Russian, "Chris, the clip is magnificent. It made us proud." He's talking about space oddity, I realize. And he means he's proud of this business we're both in. It's a nice way to be welcomed back when you've fallen from the sky.
Garrick Hagen was reading from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth by Chris Hadfield. It was abridged and produced by the Waters Company for BBC World Service.